New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is the mystical side of sexuality. My guest is Gary Lachman, formerly a songwriter and bass guitarist for the rock band Blondie. He is one of the world's foremost historians of esoteric culture. He has been interviewed 15 times previously on New Thinking Aloud on topics including Rudolf Steiner, Madame Blavatsky, Emanuel Swedenborg, P.D. Ouspensky, Colin Wilson, Aleister Crowley, Hermeticism, Carl Jung, Chaos Magic, and Russian Mysticism. His newest book, about which we've done a previous interview, is Maurice Nicole, Forgotten Teacher of the Fourth Way. Gary lives in England, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
Same here, Jeffrey. It's always a very enjoyable conversation with you.
I believe this is our 16th interview, and unlike every other interview, it's not going to be based on a particular book of your many books. We're going to talk about a general topic that sort of weaves its way throughout all of your writing whenever appropriate, the mystical side of sexuality. But since our last interview was about Maurice Nicole, that's a good starting point, because you discovered in his private diaries that were only recently revealed a side to him that I guess it was probably hidden even from his students.
Well, I think it came as a shock to everyone who found out about it. Yes, Maurice Nicole, he was started out as a British lieutenant, as it were, of C.G. Jung here in London about 100 years ago. And then after attending a lecture by P.D. Ouspensky, he changed his allegiance to the system of esoteric psychology that Ouspensky was teaching, called the Work or the Fourth Way. And that system itself was taught to Ouspensky by this very mysterious, enigmatic, esoteric teacher, G.I. Gorgiev. And I mean, that alone would make Nicole interesting, because he had Jung as a teacher, Spensky, and he also spent time with Gurdjieff in his institute in Fontainebleau in France, outside of Paris. But what came as a complete shock to me when I was asked if I'd be interested in writing a book about Nicole. And I said, yeah, he's an interesting character. And I was the person who asked me, basically commissioned me to write the book, sent me an enormous amount of material. And part of that was a 100-plus page transcript of these personal diaries that were found in a collection of letters and papers that in the possession of the family of one of Nicole's close followers, a fellow named Sam Copley, who wrote a book about Nicole. He died in the early 2000s. And in 2017, a researcher in University of Edinburgh, who's researching Nicole's life, discovered this cache of these boxes of papers and all that. And there were all these exercise books, you know, these kind of school books you would do your homework in, sort of thing. Tons of them, you know, stack of them, of this diary. And among the other interesting things in there, his reflections on Jung and meeting Ouspensky and his interpretation of his dreams. And he was involved in the early days of this kind of rivalry going on in England between the Freudians and the Jungians and all of that, was apparent obsession with sex. And as I say in the book, it was an obsession he pursued with one hand. If you get my drift, that was that's a definition of pornography that's been attributed to Voltaire and some other people as well. It's the literature one reads with one hand, and so this was a complete shock. But out of, I said, 1,000+ pages of this transcription, this file of this diary, 90% of it is about Nicole's obsession with sex.
An obsession with sex could be a psychological aberration, but Nicole was a very astute person, both psychologically and in terms of esoteric and mystical culture. Surely he was aware of the fact that many of his contemporaries in, say, the Order of the Golden Dawn, followers of Aleister Crowley, or even followers of Gurdjieff, used sex very deliberately. And was that his intention, or was it more of a fetish?
Well, I think it was his intention, but it was something that was wrapped up in it was a very complex, should we say, activity, to put it that way. You have to go back 100 years ago, a century ago, or even a bit earlier, because the first diaries that we have, they start just before, sort of just around World War I or something like that, or maybe a little bit after. Nichols' kind of mystical pursuit of a kind of sexual ideal, a kind of eternal feminine, he does. There's a kind of devotional practice to a sort of imaginary, eternal feminine, ewige weibliche, as Goethe calls her at the end of Faust, who leads us upwards. But it's mixed in with all of these kind of, at times, guilt-ridden, shame-ridden, a sense of transgression against the forbidden and all this kind of thing, which in many ways goes back to his childhood. He was brought up Scott Presbyterian, so it's a very dour religion. And basically, he was brought up to believe that he's just sinful. And in the diary, there's this remarkable document that's called Unclean Thoughts. It's unfinished. It's a fragment. It's an essay. But it's Nicole trying to explain or trying to describe this obsession with what he calls unclean thoughts that it started when he was a teenager, an adolescent. We all have them then. You know, we all have them then. So he had the same sort of fantasies we all have then. But they became linked to him, to his religious aspirations, his spiritual aspirations. And there's something about the notion of transgression or the forbidden that is associated both with his sexual fantasies and with his spiritual aspirations. And yes, you say, I mean, at the time, others were, you know, pursuing this a bit more openly, though. Because this was something that was very, very private to Nicole. I mean, I get the impression that no one around him knew. He may have talked about it with somebody, but I just don't get the impression that he did. Which is an interesting thing, because for a great deal of his life, he was living in these communes, these sort of off-the-grid communities that he was setting up in what's known as the home counties outside of London, sort of the suburbs 40, 50 miles outside of London, that sort of thing. So you wonder, like, okay, that's going on. He's in the context of people. But other people, like Aleister Crowley, you mentioned, I mean, he was outwardly combining his obsession, complete, voracious appetite for sex with his magic, his pursuit of magic. And in some ways, Nicol himself pursues a kind of magic, but it's more about getting into these exalted states than sort of wanting something to happen, you know, using sex as a kind of energy to inform the talisman or something like that to get money, which is what Crowley's doing all the time, and that he died pretty much broke gives you an idea it doesn't necessarily work. But with Nicol, it was much more of kind of getting into these exalted sort of states. But the downside of it was, if it didn't quite work, he would go into this kind of, you know, shame-ridden hangover, you know, from it.
I suppose if we look at the ancient tantric traditions, which involve sexuality and go back many, many centuries, if not thousands of years, the idea is that the very things that are taboo and that are forbidden by conventional society are pathways to higher consciousness if approached in a disciplined way.
Well, yes, this is the so-called left-hand path, And most Westerners, when they hear Tantra, it's, ooh, it's sex. No, it's, and it is, but it's also eating meat. And it's also drinking alcoholic beverages. And it's also eating certain kinds of grain that were taboo. And a couple other things too. I forget. I think there's five. I'm not a tantric scholar, so I don't remember all of them, but I know that's the case. So the one that we hear about the most in the West is about sex. And it's a way of using the energy of sex to achieve kind of mystical states. And you have, you know, Siva and Shakti and all of that. So there is this kind of union of the polarities, that make up the manifest universe we exist in, and that, you know, we ourselves can participate in this kind of exalted way, you know, with the sexual partner. But of course, yes, at the same time, it could just be banal, you know, having sex, which, you know, we all know sometimes we come away from it, we think, my God, oh, you know, you sort of feel bad about it in a certain way. You're sort of driven to it. But so this was something that with Nicole as well, like he you can tell in these diaries that he does achieve these kind of exalted sort of states, you know, at times. And it's a transformative experience. It's a visionary experience. And he communes with this deity, this feminine god. And, so yeah, it is something, but I think in him personally, he wasn't able ever to get over kind of the early indoctrination into kind of, you know, sexist sin in some way. Unlike with Crowley, who never, you know, worried about that in one way or other.
A lot of the present esoteric culture that we know of today and in our world, what we would think of as New Age culture that you've written about a great deal, let's say, comes out of Theosophy and Madame Blavatsky and elsewhere. It was out of the Victorian era in England. It was thought of, and maybe not correctly, but it was thought of as a rather prudish period in Western culture.
Oh yeah, well, certainly that was, you know, so the whole idea of you know, ladies covering their ankles. I mean, I think at the time there was even sort of like tablecloths, you know, over tables. They went down so low that you didn't see sort of the very bottom of, which was somehow, you know, Freud must have, you know, had a field day with something like that. So there was this, and again, the earlier, before that, it wasn't so much. I mean, there's this sort of period where it's kind of like sort of the bawdy, you know, Fanny Hill, you know, sort of thing, where it's just sex is this healthy kind of, you know, rustic, you know, just roll in the hay kind of thing. It's just part of a healthy life. Then it sort of gets with the Romantics and then into the Victorian period. And this is something that a writer who's influenced me a lot, Colin Wilson, who's written a book called The Origin of the Sexual Impulse. Which goes into trying to do an analysis of the male sexual impulse, and it has a lot to do with imagination. But the forbidden becomes something that kind of is this kind of spice. You don't really have the same kind of notion of forbiddenness, say, in that sort of bawdy kind of period, or Tom Jones or something like that. It's just like a romp. Then it becomes this kind of, sex becomes this kind of, you mentioned Crowley, his career when he started out, basically when he was adolescent, early teen, is that he wanted to commit the unforgivable sin. And the unforgivable sin in some way had to do with sex. And, you know, he came out of this Victorian background. So this whole notion of somehow it being forbidden and, you know, dark and transgressive is something that, it just informs kind of certainly male sexuality, as you say, during that Victorian period and after. And we still have that today, even though we all know, oh, it isn't really forbidden and all that, and it's not really dirty and nasty, but we still want to go have a dirty weekend.
One of the other aspects of sexuality, of course, is the one-pointed concentration that people achieve in orgasm. And it's very difficult for people in normal circumstances to have that sort of intense concentration. I seem to recall studies suggesting that the average person cannot hold their concentration firmly on a single object for more than 30 seconds.
Well, unfortunately, some sexual encounters last about that long, but maybe not these days with Viagra, but no, you're absolutely right. That's one of the things about the magic. You know, that's the tantra. Instead of giving way to the orgasm when it just feels you stop, you hold it back, you keep it back, you retain it. You know, this is the whole philosophy of the male not climaxing. I mean, the female, the other partner, certainly enjoys that. But you retain that energy. And in the Hindu tradition, the whole idea of retaining the semen, too. And this is something that Gurdjieff talked about, too. Retaining the semen, it has a chemical reaction or alchemical reaction in the body that helps to create the diamond body, or as Gurdjieff called it, the Kesgen body. And this would be the body you would have, you know, whatever shape or form it might be, when you pass on after you die. You know, instead of the, you know, more democratic notion that, you know, when we die, we all have souls, and we die, they go on. Gurdjieff said, no, you have to create one through friction and struggle and all this sort of thing. And he said one of the elements that you is actually part, you know, because he was a materialist in a certain way. One of the elements that's actually a part of creating this immortal body is male sperm. So he said, like, it's basically in that this huge book he wrote, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. He talks about this, and he says that, basically, if you get rid of it through either masturbation or sodomy, you're throwing away this material that you actually need for, you know, to create your diamond body. So if it isn't being used to procreate, that it's its proper function. And Gurdjieff left behind quite a few illegitimate progeny. So he made sure that his got to the right place, as it were. But this was the whole idea that and Crowley himself talks about mixing the male fluids and the female fluids. And this has some peculiar characteristics and power. And I think in one of his books, he even says it has, you know, more potential power than nuclear energy or something like that.
Well, if we go back to Freud, who regarded, I think, the sexual impulse, I think he may have referred to it as the pleasure principle, as central to human psychology altogether, and it makes sense in a way in terms of Darwin's theory of evolution, that the survival of the species depends upon it. But Freud also wrote about sublimation, the idea that you can take that energy and focus it to, let's say, artistic creation.
Yes. He said libido could be sublimated into other things. So in many ways, this was his explanation for works of genius. So, you know, the artist, painter, poet, you know, musician, whatever, frustrated sexually in some way, you know, again, the kind of alchemical transformation of that libido energy, you know, into something else. But Jung had a different idea where he didn't think there was a specific sexual kind of energy. So with Jung, Freud, there's libido is a specifically sexual sort of energy. And the whole idea that you would have to transform it into something else, that's the sublimation. Whereas Jung said, no, this kind of life energy, it goes to sex, but it also goes into, you know, food, and it also goes into artistic pursuits and all this kind of thing. And he had a less specific and a vaguer notion. And this is something Nicol picked up on as well. He just called it interest. So we're born with a certain capacity to be interested in things, right? And sex is one of those things. And certainly it's a very, very big thing for men, at least. But it's not a case of having to turn that energy into something else in order to pursue something, say, spiritual or something like that. It's just that it's another avenue through which interest, you know, satisfies itself. And I mean, Jung, you know, I mean, Freud, I mean, for somebody who wrote about sex, and sex was everything, he basically gave up on sex in his early 40s, if I'm not mistaken. He basically said, I'm just not interested in that stuff anymore. Whereas Jung, we know, he had, you know, more than one Sora Mystica. You know, he had, you know, Tony Wolfe, and there was others around him. And he had Emma, long-enduring Emma, who put up with it all. And Jung would, you know, had different relations with different of his colleagues or his patients, whatever you want to call them, at the time. And he needed that. He said he needed that. So, there's a certain, how should we say it? In Jung's case, it had to do with this kind of alchemical, you know, sort of thing, the coincidenta oppositorum, you know, the two sides coming together and that sort of thing.
If you're familiar with the work of Jeffrey Kripal, I think you are, he writes about being in India at a time of a celebration of the goddess, and all of a sudden, unprepared and spontaneously, he finds himself in a situation where it appears as if he's having a sexual encounter with a Hindu goddess. And that became the basis of several books and really his whole theory about religion.
Lucky Jeffrey. No. I know that story, and I came upon it recently on a book I reviewed. And I guess if I understand right, he relates that also to certain kinds of, you know, UFO encounters or close encounters, abductees, where they have sexual encounters. But then it also relates back to, you know, the incubi and succubi of medieval demonology. You know, these male or female spirits or ghostly figures that come in the night to you and have sex with you, whether you want to or not. And I know a lot of that is related to this whole idea of sleep paralysis. You know, it's I haven't had any visitations from incubi and succubi, but I've certainly experienced what's known as sleep paralysis, is when when we go to sleep, in order so that when we dream, we don't flop around, you know, and wake our partner or attract predators, which is, it's evolutionarily, this is, goes back way back, our muscles go torpid. So they're slack. We can't move. We're paralyzed. But in sleep paralysis, you wake up, you are conscious, but your muscles are still torpid. I'm not saying that explains it, but I've certainly experienced that. And then you're in hypnagogic states, these in between waking and sleeping states. And you can have these very, very vivid sort of dreams that you're having at the same time that you're aware that you're half awake and in the room. So it can come across as, I'm not trying to reduce it to that, but that's sort of the familiarity with it that I've experienced myself. But if you know the literature, yes, there's all these strange stories of people being abducted by aliens, and they wind up having, you know, either strange probes, you know, things being done to them, or having some kind of sexual encounter. Who knows, you know, maybe they're breeding. I don't know myself. I'm not up on the latest about UAP and all of that, but who knows?
There's a large tradition about that, and many books talking about, you know, hybrid human alien beings that are being produced and so on. I regard it as a very significant area of folklore. But I'm under the impression that people also do it deliberately. That yes, you might be attacked at night by an incubus or a succubus, an unwelcome spirit that is going to provoke a sexual encounter with you. But there are also the welcome encounters. There are people who deliberately cultivate what they would call it a spiritual marriage, a sexual relationship with a non-physical being.
Well, no, I mean, there's psychologist and paranormal investigator, a fellow named Stan Gooch, who wrote a lot in the 1970s and 80s, actually wrote quite a bit about Neanderthal that subsequently science came to recognize as being, you know, pretty spot on. He was laughed at the time. But he talks about having an experience like that, where this feminine female kind of figure came to him first, unwanted. And he allowed it to happen, whatever was happening with them. And then he discovered that it was actually much more pleasant and fulfilling and completely, you know, transformative, experience than, normal sex. And, why? Why would that be? You know, this is the thing, because you think, oh, wait, that isn't that just a substitute? You know, isn't imaginative sex, put it that way, a substitute for real sex? But then we get into, well, what's real sex? That's the hard question. I mentioned this book by Colin Wilson, Origins of the Sexual Impulse. And he starts out by trying to understand what exactly is a sexual perversion? Well, in order to understand what a sexual perversion is, you'd have to know what non-perverted sex is, right? And the first answer is like, well, for procreation. But we all know that's not the only reason we engage in it, right? We all know that. But that was Tolstoy. Tolstoy said the only reason to have sex is for procreation. And if anything other than that is completely decadent. But I mean, he was a rather austere character in his last days. So is it for the propagation of the species? So it becomes something that it's something that's got more to do with our own individual kind of self-development. And then that becomes, well, we're not all the same, are we? You know, some people need something other than others. So we think we know what normal sex is, but we actually don't know. We think we know what a sexual perversion is, but we actually don't know. And he explores this idea. And one of the central themes, and he writes about another book called The Misfits some years later. And sex runs through all of Wilson's work. And actually, I use a lot of these concepts trying to understand Nichols' obsession with the forbidden and the transgression and all that. And some of it has to do with the forbidden and the transgressive being a kind of spice that heightens the sexual experience in some way. And how does it heighten it? Because it does exactly what you said before. It tightens the concentration. It makes us focus. You know, people install mirrors up in the ceiling so they can, you know, watch each other when they're making love. Somehow, well, you're making love already and you're watching yourself doing it. Why are you watching it? Because you want to grasp the reality that I'm making love now. I'm having sex now. The reality somehow escapes from us. And this is what the perversions are about in some way. I mean, I'm just calling them, I'm not going to list them and say, you know, which one is a perversion, which one is. I'm just saying that, you know, it could be anything. And it tends to be men more than women have the perversions because, as Nichols says in this remarkable document, men's sexuality is much more to do with imagination. And that's why men are subject to fetishism much more than women are, at least according to the studies I've read. And a fetish can be anything, you know. A fetish is anything that stimulates the sexual imagination and makes it a reality for you. So for most of us, the woman is fetish enough. You know, we're interested in her enough, sexually enough, for our imagination to be heightened enough for us to grasp the fact that, yes, we're making love to this beautiful woman and all that. But we lose grip of that. And oh, let's whip, or let's get some chains, whatever it might be, to spice things up. And the interesting thing here is, I'm sorry going on about this one point, but this is the central focus, I think, is that we talk about sexual appetites, but if you're hungry, and you visualize as you know, vividly as you can, you know, a steak or a vegan buffet or whatever it might be, no matter how perfectly you visualize that, it will not satisfy your hunger and it won't fill your stomach. And if you're thirsty and you visualize a, you know, cold beverage with the drops of moisture going down the side and all that, you try to grab it and drink it, it's not going to do that. But if you're sexually hungry, you can imagine a satisfying sexual partner, and you can bring yourself to exactly the same physiological response that you would have with an actual real life partner. You can't do that with food, and you can't do that with drink. So this says something, again, sex is, it's not just an appetite in the same kind of normal, healthy kind of five a day, you know, sort of thing. It isn't like that. It has got much more to do with imagination. And Wilson's point, it has, getting back to this notion of like, well, what's, if we're trying to understand what perversion is, what's normal, natural sex, is it's got something to do with our total development. It has something to do with our whole idea of what it means to be human and to develop as a human. That's what it somehow got to do with. And Nietzsche says, you know, a person's sexuality, you know, participates in the highest parts of their being.
Is that right? Well, that's understandable in a way when you consider some of the partners that Nietzsche was attracted to.
Well, sadly, I mean, yeah, I mean, he was the philosopher with a hammer, and the fellow who said, "I'm not a man, I am dynamite." He was a very, very timid person, and you know, he was attracted to Louis-André Salomé, who Rilke, you know, was one of his lovers, and she was a student of Freud, and all of that. But he couldn't bring himself to propose to her. He had to ask his friend Paul Ray, and naturally she turned him down. And again, in talking about, you know, self sex, auto sex, masturbation, to say it straight out, there's a good reason to think that that's probably, aside from maybe one encounter at a brothel early on, from where he most likely picked up the syphilis that later, you know, drove him insane and killed him, he probably only knew about sex from masturbation. But he was certainly aware of its power, the Dionysian explosive power of it. I mean, I would say most of us, just, or many of us, the closest thing we get to a mystical experience is a very, you know, satisfying sexual encounter, because, you know, you have that fantastic Dionysian release. You're beyond your ego. You're not in your ego anymore. You're not in yourself. You're expanded, and suddenly something takes you over that's bigger than you and powerful than you, and all of that. And this is the, I mean, people like Nicol, Crowley, Gurdjieff, and others, Uspensky too, they were aware of this. And it was, okay, can we channel that? Can we somehow funnel that energy into something so that it's not just like explosion that, you know, goes out? Can we funnel it? Can we, you know, turn it into a kind of laser beam rather than an explosion?
You're reminding me of Hemingway, actually, who writes about sexual experiences in which the earth shakes underneath you.
Maybe he's the origin of when people say, did it move for you, you know, after, and all that sort of thing. It could very well. I, again, just my own experience. I'm no tantric guru or anything like that whatsoever, you know, but, you know, I have had experiences like that. It's been like, what was that all about? You know, that was just incredibly transformed. And you feel like something you've never felt before. And there's this kind of incredible sense of some other reality, you know, there. And my God, and then it's gone. You know, it slips away from us. So all of these spiritual attempts to somehow, you know, mine that, as it were, or you know, channel it, or attempts to hold on to that fairy dust that you know, the French, the petite mort, you know, the little death, or I think it was Aristotle said, you know, a man is sad after sex. You know, there's. It is sort of like Cinderella. It is kind of like you're really excited. My God, that woman, if I only can have her, everything, you know. There's a wonderful line in Yeats about, you know, what were all the world's alarms to mighty Paris when he woke in Helen's, that first dawn in Helen's arms, you know. Mm. So this is about Paris, who's, you know, the Iliad, you know, the campaign to capture, you know, Helen, beautiful Helen, the face that launched a thousand ships. It's like, if only I could have that. Everything I want is, and all love songs are about that. You know, all love songs about this incredible transformative completion that one experiences when you finally embrace the object of desire. But the other bit is like, oh, where did that go? You know, and so the carriage turns into a pumpkin. You can't find Cinderella anywhere. She's left the building, and the man or woman wakes up with like, who, you know? So there's a kind of weird illusion, and Freud and others have said, well, this is the life force's way of getting us to perform this, you know, act. Sorry, I was going to say, if you were in a right mind, we wouldn't do it.
I know the Carole King song. The light of love shines in your eyes tonight, but will you love me tomorrow?
Well, that's exactly, that's, you know, it's Bernard Shaw is this play Man and Superman, he turned the cliche around, like women are the dreamers and men are the practical ones. But actually, it's way other way around. Men are the dreamers and women are the practical ones. But there's a character who's, this woman is pursuing him. He wants to get away from her. That's the basic plot. But every now and then, he experiences this power taking him over. And it's beyond his reason. It's beyond his logic. It's beyond his intellect. It's something other than him that has ideas and purposes in mind that transcend his. And it's godlike. Mm-hmm. It's God. I mean, I think Jung says somewhere, what happens when the God takes you? He grabs you. It's like you can't do anything about it. You're in the grip of this. And this is the closest thing I think most of us get to anything palpably kind of other taking us over?
Another way of thinking about this would be in terms of the difference between, I'll call it, for the sake of simplicity, male and female spirituality. I get the impression in general terms that female spirituality is very earthy, it's very grounded, and sex is regarded as a joyful, positive thing. Whereas male spirituality is associated with the sky gods and the idea of, you know, pursuing higher awareness and that there's something about, you know, women trying to trap us and we've got to avoid that.
Well, I guess that's the old femme fatale sort of thing too. And I'm sure, your women in the audience out there listening to this, oh God, I've heard this 150 zillion times and all that. But I have to say, you know, we wouldn't be saying it if there wasn't something to it. I think there is a certain kind of, just evolutionarily, women are the childbearing of the two. And they have to think, okay, where are we going to live? Where are we going to get the food? How's everything going to be and all that? And at one point, let us say, for the male, the woman was the ideal, but she's now become, you know, part of the everyday. And, ooh, where's that ideal? Where's that dream ahead now? Unfortunately, with many men, it turns into an affair. It doesn't have to be that, but that tends to be the thing. I mean, you know, and I guess even, look, you know, again, it's the buckshot method, you know. Evolution has hit upon this where, you know, men want to impregnate as many women as possible they can in order to spread the seed. And the women want to get the best out of the lot so that they can secure a good base and all of that. So that's kind of the two, you know, basic fundamental kind of things going on there. That probably sounds remarkably conventional. But I would think when you look at it, it seems to me that's kind of, you know, the basic blueprint of things. And so you get this contrast, you get this kind of pull between two sorts of things. And the whole idea that there's a kind of, I mean, J.H. Lawrence, he talks about the sex war and all that. So in one sense, the idea that we both sit down really cozy and comfortably and we all get along wonderfully and there's no problems and all that, that's not really living. You know, there's a tension, there's a struggle. And it could lead to disaster or it could lead to, you know, the relationship moving up to, you know, the next level, you know, a more intense, a more deeper kind of encounter.
You know, I imagine with your interest in Gurdjieff, you're probably familiar with Robert Dorop's book about sexuality, where he looks at all the different animal species and the different ways, like, for example, snails will have sex. Very, very different from humans, but it's still an expression of the same biological necessity for procreation.
Yeah, I did many years ago read Robert Dorop's books, and there's also his book on drugs in the mind. Remember, that was a must read ages ago. I think, yes, it is. But I think one of the things is Robert Ardrey, who years ago wrote the territorial imperative. And I know this story because from reading Colin Wilson, and because they were friends. And Ardrey said to Wilson that sex is a sideshow in the natural world. It's there. It's obviously it's there, but it's like, you know, food, territory, you know, that survival, that sort of stuff is more important. Whereas with humans, we're more or less, most of us have got, you know, the security down. And so sex becomes something that's much more part of our life than the natural world. And we talk about, oh, you're being beastly, you know, or his animal instinct and all that. But I think in some ways, it isn't like that because, again, imagination. There's a story about Calvin Coolidge, the president Calvin Coolidge, ages ago, probably about 100 years ago. And he and Mrs. Coolidge are on a tour of some chicken farm or some farming. It's not only a chicken farm, but it's, you know, all that, some big agricultural farming, you know, whatever set up. And they're taking separate paths around. And they go to the chicken coop or something like that. And Mrs. Coolidge asks, you know, the person showing them about the rooster, and he's saying, well, how many times a day, basically, does the rooster pay attention to the hens? All day long, ma'am. Really, really. Oh, it's constant. Oh, yes. Oh, you might mention that to Mr. Coolidge, right? Then Mr. Coolidge comes around, and the same guide, and the guide's, this is what Mrs. Coolidge wanted me to say to you. Oh, really? Oh, and does the rooster pay attention to the same hen? Oh, no, it's a different hen every time. Oh, well, tell that to Mrs. Coolidge. So the idea is that it's the strange, it's the unknown, right? The forbidden. You know, there's what you know, but then you also want what I don't know. I want that strange sort of thing. And again, I know this because I've written a book about Wilson as well, and he has an episode in his first novel called Ritual in the Dark, which could best be described as Jack the Ripper meets the Brothers Karamazov in duffel-coated post-World War II London. But there's a scene where he spent the morning making love to his girlfriend, and he has a basement flat. And he's exhausted sexually. His appetite is completely sated. You know, he's just not interested anymore. And he goes to collect the milk. You know, there's the bottles of milk up on the pavement. So he can go up the steps a bit. And as he's going up the steps, a woman walks by, and he can see up her skirt. And suddenly he's sexually excited again. He's just spent hours making love to his girlfriend and felt, okay, I'm good. And then suddenly this electric spark hits him again. Why is that? Because it's forbidden. Because it's strange. It's the unknown. So that's the spark. That's the kind of thing. And so, you know, animals can't do that. The same hen can't go, you know, pretend to be a French maid, you know, so the rooster will pay attention to her again. She can't go and, you know, whatever, put on ripped clothes to look like a pretend rape or something like that, which, you know, people do to get sexually excited. We do that. And it's, women can do that, you know, in order to keep, I'm not saying you should do this, but women can do that in order to keep their man interested in them. They can, you know, put on whatever, you know, sexy lingerie. Victoria's Secret and all shops like that make a mint, precisely because of this, because we have, because imagination is something that's, you know, what I say in the book about sex is the gift where the package is more important. The wrapping is more important than the gift. The wrapping is more important than what's inside, because what's inside is, we all know it. But
well, you've written about the power of imagination being very important in spiritual and mystical pursuits. You particularly focused on the Inklings and their cultivation of the imagination in literature. I don't get the impression that the Inklings as a group were more sexually active than, let's say, gurus. I bring gurus up because it seems as if it's very hard to be a guru without getting caught up in a scandal of some sort. But you could be an Inkling and it wouldn't be a problem.
You can cultivate the imagination, but it doesn't necessarily have to be directed at sex. I mean, in a certain way, the imagination is kind of subsidized by the sexual energy, and that's why it suddenly, you know, it becomes absolutely powerful. An interesting point is, like, you know, the Romantics, who Owen Barfield is one of the Inklings, and he's written about them quite a bit, and he's written about the imagination, like the whole idea of imagination is a way for us to participate with reality rather than, you know, escape from reality or an alternate reality. It's a way for us to actually grasp reality. But the Romantics, one of the things that paralleled the rise of sort of Romantic literature was the rise of this kind of pornography. So once people discovered you could use the imagination, you know, you can use the imagination to look at a flower or Blake and see, you know, see heaven in a flower and, you know, and all of that, Blake's grain of sand. but you could certainly, you could also use it to satisfy, you know, your sexual appetites. And this, it's a kind of romanticism. What's the word? It's a kind of, not spoiled, but it's kind of overripe romanticism when it goes into the sexual kind of realm. But one of the things I say in this book about Nickel is that take like a Playboy centerfold. I don't even know if they still exist. For me, that was when I was a kid. That was great. Whoa, find one of those. I mean, in reality, it's just a flat, two-dimensional image, right? So, I mean, in reality, that's all it is. And if you had a magnifying glass and looked at it, the image would break down into all the color components, you know, in the printing process and all that. So, in order for it to satisfy my sexual urges, I have to endow it with a kind of reality. I have to bestow a kind of reality on. And this is the same reality I said before, that, you know, it won't work with food and it won't work with drink, but it will work with sex. And I can somehow transform the flat two-dimensional Playboy centerfold into something that is living and vital for the time I'm engaged with it. And again, it triggers the same physiological response that an actual, you know, real life person would be. So take that power of imagination to bestow reality upon this flat two-dimensional, you know, image, and take it and look at nature with that. And that's what the poets do. That's what the mystics do. They somehow see this deeper reality that most of us don't see. You know, most of us, we just look, oh, it's a tree. So it's the same as some two-dimensional. That's just a tree. That's just a cloud. That's just a star, whatever. They see it, it's like, it's more. You know, it's already three-dimensional, becomes four, five, six, however many dimensionals you want to say. So in a certain sense, the kind of response we have to sexual images like this is kind of, as we say it, it's a kind of close cousin to what the poet's doing and what the mystic is doing. When the mystic looks out, you know, when Jakob Boehme saw this glint of sunlight on a silver dish, and suddenly he saw what he called the signature of nature. He peered into the inner reality of nature, this participatory experience that Barfield talks about. That's not, I don't want to reduce, but it's not that different than what goes on in this cruder kind of thing. It's the same faculty we have for bestowing reality upon things.
I presume the people who use sex as a discipline in ritual magic, that's exactly what they're going for.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you focus on, as far as I understand, you focus on, you know, the talismanic image or the symbol of the magical operation that you're involved in, what god you want to evoke, or something like that. And then it takes on a kind of, you know, talk about these hypnagogic images earlier that have a clarity and a vividness that stand out against the background of the, you know, waking reality. That's the same thing. You can visualize it in that way. And then the sexual energy informs that. And then I guess the idea is that you know, the moment of bingo, you shoot it out into the world, as it were, and that imagination carries your intention through.
If we return to the issue of scandals, I wonder, why is it that so many famous gurus get caught up in sexual scandals? And I think there's an irony, because you've already referred to Gurdjieff or the other tantric gurus. They don't hide the fact that they're sexually promiscuous, and everybody seems more or less okay with it, except for people who would say none of it is okay. And on the other hand, you have so many gurus. I once attended a lecture by Swami Muktananda, in which he went on and on about how he said, you know, if you eat a mango and a mango is very tasty, it makes you feel good. He said, I feel the same way by being celibate. That makes me feel good. And then we learn, of course, that he was, I think it's well known at this point historically, although he's beloved by many of his former students, that he engaged in sex with many of his students, and they felt abused by him.
Well, I think one of the things is, when you're a guru, you're kind of in the same situation as when you were a rock star. You know, you're going to have people around you that, you know, they'd be happy to sleep, they'd be happy to do anything. Just yeah. To be around you. Proximity to the guru is desirable. Many of them take advantage of it. I mean, some don't. I mean, celibacy, I mean, theosophy, I mean, Annabel Dashke, she said sex was beastly. She advised everyone to avoid it. So she was celibate. Rudolf Steiner, as far as I understand, was celibate. He was married twice, but there's no indication that he consummated either marriage. But others, it's not the case. And it's difficult to resist temptation, I would say, when you're in. And it's also, you know, again, it's easy to. The one guru I had any kind of contact with was a fellow named Andrew Cohen. And this was quite some years ago. He had a magazine called Enlighten Next. And they were pretty well together. They had some impressive property here in London and other places as well. So I wasn't involved in his group, but he invited me to the place. I gave talks there and stuff like that. And I wrote some things for the magazine. And then I didn't hear anything for years. And then subsequently it came out. It's like, oh, what you just said, it all came out that he was turned into this abusive character and sex was a big part of it. Sex is a big part of it because it's control. It's power. You know, it's domination. This is sadly part of the male sexual impulse, is this notion of power. I mean, it isn't all gentle. I mean, again, it's like you penetrate. So there's something that, how should we say it? I don't know. I mean, I'm not the only person, I don't think, to understand that it's best when you don't ask for it. You just take it and it's there. Then it's bang, it's in the moment. And wow, that takes you out of yourself. All right. But that can be abused. That can be abused. And I think this is what happens where you find these people in these positions of power. They already have lots of people around them who are happy to do whatever they want and probably feel it's part of their spiritual development to do that. And then it's hard to not give way to the temptation. And then once you give way to the first temptation, the second one is so much easier, and then bang, bang, bang. So, yeah, I think that's, Uspensky had heard these rumors that Gurdjieff was sleeping with, you know, different women at the Prairie at his institute. And although he probably knew that was probably true, he himself was rectitude incarnate. He was very, very tactful. You know, very, very much a conventional character aside from his esoteric interest. But he squashed all the rumors. But this is one of the things that he felt like, I'm beginning to have my doubts about Mr. G, if this is true. Because there is something about that, being able to exercise that power over others and certainly over women.
Well, I can say, as a student of criminology, we learned that among rapists, the drive to commit rape is not about sexual fulfillment. It's about power.
Yeah, I mean, there's something, how should we say, we all want a certain sense of feeling able, powerful, there, you know, capable, and some individuals lack that. And it's a crushing sense of some kind of inferiority or something like that, or non-existence in a way. And they achieve a sense of existence, they achieve a sense of being alive by, sadly, through this domination of others. And it can be taken to horribly, horribly, horribly extreme degrees. But yeah, that's the sort of thing, you know, if you feel a kind of existential lack, and then you can have this, you know, quivering person, you know, below you, suddenly you feel alive and strong and all that. And it lasts for about however long that lasts, but there's nothing stable to keep it, to maintain it in the person. And they, you know, fall back into this abyss and they seek out another.
There's so many facets to sex. I think we could keep talking about this for a long time. I'm thinking of Dante and Beatrice, the idea of the feminine ideal who will take you into alternate realities and share with you mysteries that you can't get to any other way.
Well, that's another side of it. That's the idealism. That's the poetic side of it. That's the Jung would say the anima. One of the things I say in the book is that the anima animates us. Mm-hmm. We become alive. In her presence, and no challenge is too great. no goal unachievable. When that's she's there, and encouraging, go get him, Tiger, kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, that's the whole, again, the eternal feminine, that's the side of it, and this was, I think a lot of women are like, oh, Jesus, eternal feminine. I go back to Bernard Shaw. He said, women are just men in petticoats. So this is a very practical kind of view, but most of us know that's not true. It's funny. And he's saying that so that he can cure a lot of besotted, moon-eyed lovers from, wasting their time, pining over some woman who dumped them, there's more important things than that. But at the same time, he himself, he's like Goethe, like he's drawn towards this eternal kind of feminine. And the actual women you meet, they might not want to be receptacles of the eternal feminine. They might not want to do that. Just like men aren't necessarily always the knight in shining armor who are going to come in and be wonderful and all that kind of thing. But we somehow, I think if we were left with only the banal facts of biological necessity, none of us would be interested in it. None of us would be particularly interested in it. There has to be this other thing going on there. And whether it's a trick by the life force to get us to perform the acts that would continue the species, or whether some reality that transcends the biological comes through, and we recognize that and we participate in it. That's something I think we have to decide for ourselves.
Well, Gary Lachman, this has been a fascinating discussion. I'm delighted to be with you once again, and I want to thank you for opening up to this topic and sharing your many insights with the New Thinking Aloud audience.
Well, once again, Jeffrey, it was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you once again, and for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here. Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.